Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Back with you, my friends, and here we are. Hey, what do you worry about? You know, every time we start a radio program, we have a lot of things to put together. You know, it's a lot of research and engineering and magic. But it seems these days that everything is risky. And yet, you know, if you worry and if you're concerned, worry is bad for you. If it, you know, if it makes you anxious, you get uncertain. And if you're uncertain, it makes you sicker. If you feel worried all the time, worried people are unhealthier than people who don't worry so much. Yet, how much are you supposed to worry? What's sensible and what's not? Maybe we could judge our fear and validate our fear. And this is the issue of today's program today. Today, I'm kind of concerned about fear itself, and I want to kind of introduce you to the idea of trusting what you feel and not trusting what you feel. Because think about fear. Fear feels like anything but a cool, detached computation of the odds. It doesn't feel like you're, you know, when you feel fear, you're not saying, I've weighed all the evidence and I know this is it and therefore I have the conclusion. No. But it's precisely what it is. It's a lightning-fast risk assessment performed by your reptilian brain, which is ever on the lookout for danger. So there we are as reptiles, and the way all animals and reptiles survived is they look for danger. Who wants to eat me? Who wants to hurt me? How could I get hurt? This part of our brain, which is the very same as it was back in the old reptilian days, it flags perceptions. It sends out alarm messages. And before you have a chance to think, your system gets flooded with adrenaline. It's the way our ancestors evaluated risk before we had statistics, you know, before we had numbers and warnings and stuff like that. As a result of these emotional algorithms, ancient threats like spiders and snakes, those are things that, you know, we really were learned, taught to fear because they had signs of danger. And now, snakes and spiders will cause fear out of proportion to the real danger they pose because spiders aren't scary, right? I mean, you have to have a black widow spider who's carrying some great toxin who's going to come up to you from the banana plant or something, you know. I mean, so why are we so afraid when we see a spider? But this old brain of ours, this old antique brain of ours responds to spiders and snakes as well. Because snakes were at one point dangerous and at one point could eat your babies, you know. So how do you evaluate something? How do you evaluate something with the real danger that it has? Like, for example, speeding. Speeding, motorized vehicles are newcomers to this landscape of life, right? New vehicles, they're brand new. They've been around a short time, less than 100 years. The instinctive response to being approached rapidly when you see something coming towards you is to freeze. That's the instinctual response. When you see deer caught in headlight, it's the instinctual response. If something comes at you fast, the first thing you do is try to reduce the predator's ability to see you. And that's why you freeze. If you move or run, you become more visible. But that doesn't help when what's speeding towards you is a car, you know what I mean? So you could have this freeze effect. But there you see, right there, you know, you see people who say, I don't know what happened, I got frozen at that moment. Well, that's an instinctual response. Don't move because you don't want to become a better target. You don't want to be seen. See, if you freeze, maybe they won't see you anymore. So we fear things, you know, we fear unlikely events. You know, our primitive brain produces reflective actions before the situation is even consciously perceived. But fear strengthens memory. Catastrophes such as earthquakes, plane crashes, and terrorist incidents completely capture our attention. As a result, we overestimate the odds of these dreadful but infrequent events and underestimate how risky ordinary events are. So we have a great fear of a terrorist attack, right? I mean, walking around for a good while after 2001 with this kind of, oh, is it going to happen now? Is it going to happen now? Because it was a big event. But we don't have fears of smaller things that are happening that are equally dangerous. The more we see something, the more common we think it is, and if we are watching the same footage over and over again, like the attack on 9/11 on the World Trade Center, it's going to induce fear. It's going to place an imprint in your mind to the point where if you hear an airplane flying low overhead, you immediately think it's some kind of an attack and you have a panic reaction or an internal reaction because it's more present. During 2001, a lot of people, a vast majority of people, decided to drive instead of take flights because they became so unaware, they became so afraid of airplanes. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, talking about risk, risk assessment, and fear. So if many people, they decided they would not fly anymore. And it was estimated that roughly 1,000 additional people died from automobile accidents than would have died. Because it sent so many people to the roads driving that it increased the death toll on the roads by 1,000. 1,000 people who feared flying, thinking they would die flying, which the odds are very tiny, of course, died in an auto accident because they could have flown instead. You know, they traveled a long distance. Now, there are other things that we fear, but we don't kind of get to it. For example, humans are not prepared to deal with risks that don't produce immediate consequences. Now, this is a thing, you see. If you have something that causes an immediate consequence, like if you drink a poison and you get sick, or if you, you know, that's one thing. But if you're smoking cigarettes, that's not an immediate consequence. You know when people stop smoking? When they get really sick from smoking, when they're in the hospital because they can't breathe, that's when it really touches them. But because you can't feel the consequences of smoking or eating a cupcake or putting on a little food every time because you don't have the immediate part of it, the brain does not send out the fear signals. So you don't look at a cream-filled cupcake. I had this invention the other day. What was it? Oh, somebody invented a cupcake that was a German forest cake. Black forest, right. Black forest cupcake. Nice idea. Cherry inside. Delicious. And filled it with cream inside. Does that not sound luscious? You look at that and you say, there's that. And then on the other hand, there are my sunflower sprouts. So what does your body do? Your body says, well, eat that one. But you don't think about it. You don't think about the risks associated with it. But then on the other hand, you don't think of the risks about the sunflower sprouts that may be carrying, you know, maybe unwashed or something. We don't think about things that don't have immediate consequences. We tend to leave them out. When we get to the consequence where we get fat and we say, oh, now we have to stop eating, or we start choking, now we have to stop smoking, then we think about it. It's understanding how small risks add up that result in a lot of, for example, unplanned pregnancy. At most points during the menstrual cycle, the odds of pregnancy are very low. But after 1 year of unprotected sex, 85% of the couples become pregnant. After a year of unprotected sex, 85% will become, even though there's a very small chance of when it could possibly happen. So one of the things we want to know about, we don't want to know about global warming because it's not happening. We don't want to know about eating the wrong foods or smoking. They don't send off those amygdala. Smoking hasn't been around long enough, you know. And fat hasn't been around long enough. But if it's attached to our past, that's one thing. Or if it's very dramatic, that's another thing. Or if it has an immediate consequence, it's a third. Now, here's another interesting thing about fear. When we have a sense that we can control an outcome, we tend to take a risk voluntarily. For example, I met a man who said, he went out with a woman, and the woman went up to his apartment, and then when he got up there, she got really wacky on him. She started to assault him and actually went after him with a knife. So I asked him, I said, well, you didn't know her, and you just met her at a bar. What made you bring her up to your apartment? He said, because I figured, what could anybody do to me? You know, she's a woman, I'm a man. How could she possibly hurt me? The risk assessment was there. Yet women will bring men to their homes where the size difference and danger is definitely there. But if you really feel like you could control men, then you're not worried about inviting the man up to your apartment. You could find a way. See? So if you believe that you could control an outcome, if it turns bad, I know how to control it, you tend to take more risks. And there are certain people who take more risks, like there are people who have an affair, you know, when they're married or something, because they figure, well, I can deal with it when it comes up. Whereas other people who don't believe they could deal with the consequences don't do that. So this thing about being able to control an outcome is a very important thing. That's one of the reasons why we do it. Now, here's another one. The insurers in the United Kingdom used to offer discounts to drivers who purchased cars with safer brakes. They don't do it anymore. There were fewer accidents, but there weren't fewer accidents if you had better brakes, just different accidents. It's the same reason that vehicles most likely to go out of control in snowy conditions are those with four-wheel drive. Isn't that funny? If you got two-wheel drive, you think you got a bigger risk. If you have four-wheel drive, but the biggest number of accidents are people with four-wheel drive. And get this, people with safety belts. People who hook up, people who wear those safe belts. Now, why do you wear a seat belt? You wear a seat belt because, and what happens is you wear a seat belt and you're now driving a four-wheel drive, so you believe you could take more risk. If you don't have a four-wheel drive, you drive very slowly on ice and snow, or you don't drive at all. So it is the people who believe that they have protection in some way, the people who believe that take more risks. Both cases, you know, people have preferred levels of risk, and they modulate their behavior to keep risk at a constant level. So these features that are designed to increase safety, four-wheel drive, seat belts, airbags, they wind up making people die because they drive faster. They take more chances. I think it was some man named, I remember, Eric Slovic, a researcher, said it's like having diet soda with dinner. You know what I mean? It's like you get this idea that if you have a diet soda with dinner, you could have ice cream for dessert because you've kind of controlled the risk factor. Now, when we're thinking about risk, and I'm going to be asking you about your own risks and your own fears as we get later in the show, let's think about teenagers. You know, why can't we teach teenagers about risk? Here's a good question. Why won't they learn if we tell them? Well, here's the problem. The problem is, keep in mind that when you have a risk danger assessment that's rapid, that results in you feeling fear, by the time you feel fear, you have a feeling of fear, not a thought of fear, right? It's a feeling. Your body has this reaction, which means your amygdala is sending off a signal. It is saying the following to you. I spot something that I know is dangerous, and I want you to feel frightened of it. I want you to be wary. If you don't have the experience of knowing for sure that this is dangerous, if you haven't lived through the danger of something, you don't have that gut reaction. Now all you have is a mind reaction. Now all you have is that your parents or your mother told you, be careful when you talk to strange men. But if you've been beaten around a few times or had some hard time speaking to strange men, the amygdala responds with a feeling. If you don't respond, if you don't have the experience, you have the thought. The thought, I should not climb on the high bars, because if I climb on the high bars, I may hurt myself, my mother told me, doesn't stop you from climbing on the high bars as much as falling once or twice. So because of experience and the lack of experience, the best we could do is ask teenagers to fear something that they don't fear. They don't feel. It's just going to be up in their brain. So you try to drive it at them. Where was I the other day? I was in a restaurant, and I heard some young girl, must have been 6 years old, saying to her father, is that 50 calories you're eating, or is it 55 calories, Daddy? You know, you better not be eating 55 calories because you'll get fat. She was like six. You should go with less dressing. She was 6 years old, but it was kind of obviously drummed into her brain. There's another part of risk assessment that a lot of us do, which is this, it doesn't happen to me, and that's what happens a lot to teenagers. It won't happen to me. Hey, if you smoke, you may get cancer. Yeah, but what about all those people who don't get cancer? If you know, it's not going to happen with me. You overestimate the odds yourself. You overestimate the odds of things like contracting HIV or syphilis if you have sex. One study found that teens thought a sexually active girl had a 60% chance of getting AIDS. That's what the teenagers think, which is not true. So why do they do it anyway? Why do you become sexually active if you believe that 60% of the girls are going to get AIDS? Because you may not be rational about risk, but you may be too rational. You see, sometimes when you overestimate something, it does something to you, and it makes your body not believe it, and you tend to ignore it. Like, a teenager does not have a way of saying, this is truly not good for me, because they don't feel it on the inside. And then, on top of that, you have to compare it with the risk of not fitting in or not feeling good now or not joining the party. And what the teenager will do is they will abandon the intellectual risk that they know they have in place of the immediate pleasure of the acceptance of what they're getting now. And it's only over time that we learn it's not such a good idea. There are certain people who tend to have a much greater sense of risk, and they have, you know, like a risk thermostat. Men take many more risks with their bodies and lives than women do. Men do. That's why male insurance, young man insurance, costs so much, because the insurance companies figure out that's the person who's going to have the greater risk, and it is specifically age 15 to 25, male, automatically, highest insurance rates possible. A price of testosterone. It's the cost. You got that goody stuff, it's going to cost you. Testosterone inclines men to take more risks than women, but age and situation matter as much as gender. Men who are 15 to 25 are very risky prone compared to the same age women or older people. They have much more risk. But then there are other people who are just not risk types. You know, they don't take risks. You know, there are certain conservative people who would just never take a risk at all. Now, let's talk about some of the other irrational things we have. We worry about teenage marijuana, and we warn the kids about teenage marijuana. We tell them, you're going to die if you smoke dope. You're going to die because if you smoke it, then you're going to go to heroin, then you're going to go to cocaine, then you're going to become an addict, then you're going to become this and that. Yet, if they play football, we say, oh, how wonderful. What a great thing. Well, you know, 13 teenage players died of football-related injuries last year. None died of marijuana. Yet, the thing we'll do, marijuana will impair driving far less than the number one drug used by all teenagers, which is alcohol. We don't warn as much about alcohol as we do about marijuana. So alcohol, and so we encourage them to do alcohol, we encourage them to do sports. And really, sports are the biggest of all risks. Risk the injuries, the permanent injuries that happen from sports is something else. Then we have this other fear. We have another fear where we believe that natural things are not as frightening as unnatural things. So, like, we fear a nuclear plant, but we'll sit in the sun all day long. Well, the sun is a nuclear plant. That's radiation, you know. I'm not saying you shouldn't sit in the sun. But because it's natural, we have a built-in bias for the natural. There was a California town that chose a toxic poison made from chrysanthemums over a milder artificial chemical to fight mosquitoes. Now, the one that's made from chrysanthemums, when you spray it, creates cancer. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to spray. But because it came from chrysanthemums, they said, oh, well, it only came from chrysanthemums. How bad could it be? I mean, malaria is natural, too, you know. And so are deadly mushrooms natural. Our built-in bias for this, you know, we have this kind of, we see what's natural as safe, and we regard the new and unnatural as frightening. Any sort of novelty, including new and unpronounceable chemicals, evokes a low-level stress response, you know, low-level one. One report of lavender and tea tree oil products caused abnormal breast development. Lavender. The media shrugged it off. The activists got quiet when they heard about it. But artificial chemicals, we would have 100 different things immediately published about every one. Finally, you know, though the odds of dying in a terror attack rise or contracting Ebola are infinitesimal, the effect of this chronic stress caused by constant fear is very significant. It increases the likelihood of clinical depression and diabetes. It impairs your memory of your fertility and contributes to long-term cardiovascular damage. Fearing in your mind and listening to your body and having your fear reaction. You know, phobias, people who have phobias who don't function too well because they have phobias. Oh, there are the volumes. Okay, phobias have a problem. You have a problem when you have phobias because you're listening to the amygdala firing off these triggers saying, danger, danger, danger. Now, if you have a phobia about doorknobs, for example, as many people do, touching a doorknob, and someone says to you, now, look, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to touch the doorknob, then you touch the doorknob, and the person has a phobic reaction. It is coming from some basic primitive instinct. It takes a while to learn how to get past it, but it is the primitive instincts that lead to the kind of crippling fears that many people have. So let's see how well you do for judging mortal threats. Then we'll take a little break, and when we come back, I'll take your calls at 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. Listen, while I'm mentioning it, we're doing a project, and in this project we have some openings for both clerical and possible even managerial paid help to work with me here at the DeMille Center. So that's a possibility. You would call my office for that, 212-757-4488. Let me take some mortal threats here now. How good is your grasp of risk? I'm going to ask you some questions. Make me some notes. What's more common in the United States, suicide or homicide? What do you think? Write it down. Let me see. Go ahead. Jonna, you answer here. Jonna, who's in the studio with me, helping me out today. What do you think, Jonna? Suicide or homicide? What do you think is more? What's the most frequent cause of death in the United States? What is more frequent? Do you think pool drowning or falling out of bed? What do you think? Is it a little surprising? What are the top five causes of accidental death in America? Top five causes, and we'll take motor vehicle as number one. Accidental death, what do you think they are? I'll give you the answers later, but what do you think the top five are? What do you think after automobile deaths? Next accident. You think it's falling out of an airplane? You think it's stepping on a spider? What do you think it is? Number four, what are the two primary causes of non-accidental death in the United States? What do you think they are, number one and number two? Actually, let's change it this way. The answer happens to be cancer and heart disease, but which do you think kills more women, cancer or heart disease? What do you think? What has killed more Americans, bird flu or mad cow disease? Which one do you think has killed more Americans? How many Americans die from AIDS every year? Do you think it's 12,000, 129,000, or 1,200,000? What kills more Americans? No, how many Americans do you think die from diabetes every year? Do you think it's 72,000, 700,000, or 7,800,000? You got a guess on that one? How about this? What kills more Americans, appendicitis or salmonella? And finally, what kills more Americans, pregnancy and childbirth or malnutrition? What do you think? So there's your questions, and now let me give you some of your answers. Would you like to hear your answers? Well, what kills the greatest, the most common in the United States, more common is suicide. There are more suicides than there are homicides, believe it or not. It's hard to believe. The most frequent cause of death in the United States is whether pool drowning or falling out of bed is pool drowning. Yes, there's a lot of death. What are the top five causes of accidental death? Now, this is kind of fun. The second one, too, is drug overdose. But drug overdose, you're so happy you did it, right? Drug overdose could also mean using prescription medications that, you know, doing them wrong. Drug overdose is number one. Number two is fire. Number three is choking. Number four is falling down a flight of stairs. Believe it or not, one of the leading causes of death. What's killed more Americans, bird flu or mad cow disease? Neither. No American has ever died from either one. It was a trick. And what are the, let me see, how many Americans die from AIDS? It's 12,000. How many Americans die from diabetes? It's 72,000. It was a smaller number. What kills more Americans, appendicitis or salmonella? It's appendicitis. And what kills more Americans, pregnancy and childbirth or malnutrition? And the answer is malnutrition. Yep. Kills many more than childbirth. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, some new and different music, something you've never heard before, I hope. And in fact, something for you to do. Here's music you could listen to. You're going to turn up. As soon as we get back from the break, I'm going to play some music. You turn up the music and you stand up and see what happens to you. We'll be right back. Like I said, it's time to get up and move a little, my friends. the studio with me, Jonna. Jonna, can I ask you a question? Is it true you have to pull down the microphone, right? Oh, you can't hear me on delay. Is it true your mother is studying belly dancing?
She is taking belly dancing classes at the YMCA in Park Slope on 9th Street.
Is she really?
Yes. She loves it. She's 67 years old. She loves it so much. She never misses it.
You know, I've heard so many people doing that, and it seems like it's a great thing. A great thing. Belly dancing. Hey, your mom.
It's fun. It's a high energy. It's good exercise. You really work your stomach. You work out. You sweat. It's great music.
Have you seen
what could be better in a workout class?
Have you seen your mother do belly dancing yet?
Not yet, but I saw her. She went her beautiful belt that she bought with the sequin, with the coins and everything.
And she loves it.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. Thank you, Jonna. Jonna, who's brought to us by her mother, right? Your mom originally was a listener, and then she brought Jonna, and Jonna listened, and then Jonna heard a call for clerical help. And then Jonna came over and said, let me help, and became a part of the staff here, which is a terrific thing. Yeah, it's a good thing. Hey, 212-209-2900, fear. What's inordinate fear? What's too much fear? When does fear become phobia? You know, you must be worried about your own fear. Is it right to be afraid? Not right to be afraid? Are you too afraid? Too little afraid? There are certain people who are afraid all the time. You know, I mean, the best way to... they're usually a kind of person who is very intellectual. They're up in their mind, you know. They think and they're trying to think through everything and they're trying to figure out everything. Those kind of people who are the figure-outers tend to be a little more frightened. Because, again, even if you don't have the experience of it, your mind keeps it so present by working it over in your mind over and over again. You've got to give your body a chance to tell you when you should be frightened or not frightened. So if someone, for example, can't get up in the morning and they say, hey, I can't move my leg, I'm scared. This, of course you're scared. Your body is giving you a signal, and of course there's fear there. I understand that. But if you know that this person who you care about has a sciatica condition or something like that, or some kind of a, you know, well, you're going to get through this. But, you know it, but they don't know it, so they're really frightened. So you have to kind of, you got to kind of listen to your fear, and as much as it tells you something, but somehow not to let that fear guide you into a panic decision. Many people I know who get frightened quickly run to medication. You know, they got to take a pill. I got to take something. And very often when it comes to pain, and physical pain specifically, the healthier step is to take the medication once the pain has de-peaked, come off the peak, not once it's at its peak, because the spike, the first thing that happens when it hits you initially, is the initial pain, and that pain will come down. And when it does come down, if you still want the medication, then you take it, but it's not to take it at the peak of the pain. Ideally, especially if it's a recurrent pain. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. 212-209-2900. Being a little too frightened can also lead you to suspiciousness. You get to a point where you just don't know who to trust and how to trust and what to do. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille with you. WBAI 99.5. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. We'll get that call queued up right away, my friends. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. This is Jerry.
Hello, Jerry.
How are you?
Good.
I'm getting much better. I've been to you, over
the years. Oh, Jerry, of course. Okay. How are you, Jerry?
Hi,
talk
I'm
just a little louder
better.
For me, Jerry.
Okay, I'm on my cell phone. I am doing much better, but I fear, as you knew, I fear everything. I fear fear. I fear tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest fears are tomorrow, not being in the moment.
Yes, you always did, and yet...
I always did, but I'm working so hard on it.
Well, how has it changed?
I'm not worried about tomorrow. I'm not worried about dying. I'm not worried about getting sick. I'm not worried about having a companion.
Right, thinking about living.
I'm not worried. I'm not worried about living alone for the rest of my life, possibly.
Do you still have a companion?
I moved out. I left my husband last November.
Yeah, great. Okay, because that's what I remember. I remember you had this tremendous fear of being alone.
I was, but the funny thing is, I'm the one who left.
Yeah, right.
I'm the one who left.
You were afraid he was going to leave you, and you were going to... You're going to do anything so that he wouldn't because
yes.
he was so well,
he
terrified.
He wanted to separate for a year and do a trial separation. So I did it. I did it. I did the whole nine yards, and I'm doing great. And I possibly might not want to live with him anymore.
That's a wonderful thing. Not wonderful that you may not want to live with him, but that you don't need to live with
him. I don't need anybody. I don't need anybody. I just need myself. For the
Jerry,
very
nice
first
news.
Time in my life, I need myself. And believe it or not, love myself. I'm a great person.
You are a great person. Yeah, and I've told you, you are a great person. Thank you. Thank you for calling, and thanks for sticking with us. And congratulations.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, you know, fears die out a great deal, and especially, you know, age helps with fears, because like I said, the amygdala learns. Oh, yes, it's lightning. That's enough of that. No, it's only lightning. It's only this. The fear we have of separation is enormous, especially men. Men have the greater fear of separation than women do. You know, men, I mean, they are so attached, and they just stay attached. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille, let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hi,
yes.
This is Angela. I'm listening to your show, and... I have a long history of fear. Some people say I'm too overly fearful, and some people say I'm not fearful enough.
Well, let me see. Who tells you you're not fearful enough, either your parents or your boyfriend?
Both my parents.
Both of your parents tell you you're not frightened enough.
Right, or they'll say I'm too fearful.
Well, which are you? You tell me.
I would say...
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of being alone.
Uh-huh. So do you live with your parents?
No, I live alone.
Hey, so there you are, afraid of being alone, and yet you live alone.
Yes.
That's terrific. You know what you're doing. I mean, you keep in mind, future generations are going to learn by the fact that you confronted your fear.
Yes, and then some people say as far as, you know, being suspicious, some people say I'm too suspicious. And then they'll say I'm not fearful when there's danger. So either way, I can't win.
Well, yes, because you're very concerned about what people say. You see, it seems to me that what people say seem to determine a great deal for you, and you resist it in many ways. What kind of things are you suspicious about?
I don't think I'm suspicious.
Oh.
I'm told by other people that I'm suspicious of people's motives or that they're trying to hurt me. And then if I'm not afraid and I do trust and I am open, then they say I should be a little more guarded, so I can't win.
So it seems like this goes back to your parents, right?
Goes back to my parents, yes.
Your parents seem to have a role with you. How old are you now?
I'm 42.
So your parents seem to have a role with you now where they believe they should tell you still what you should be afraid of. So there's a part of you that seems to be holding on to your role with them as a child. Because, you know, most people, I mean, most people at your age don't have parents warning them anymore. You say to your Mary, here's a famous expression we heard around my family. It went like this. Ma! Whenever mom was threatening or saying there was something wrong, ma! Stop it, I'm old enough. Ma! But you don't say that to your parents. I mean, you say it and you don't say it. So you've kind of gotten off. You've established a collaborative relationship with your parents where they feed your littleness by your asking them to actually keep warning you. When you feel finally that you don't, you know, you said your fear of being alone. When you're ready to confront the fear of being without them specifically, then you can start seeing that that whole fear of being alone is all about being without them. Because you don't need them to keep warning you. In fact, I would recommend to you that you tell your parents, do not warn me about everything, anything, ever. Please. I believe, and some crazy shrink on the radio told me that I would grow up much faster if you stopped doing it. And then as soon as they start doing it again, and they say, you know, you shouldn't trust those crazy shrinks who are on the air, what you got to do is hang up the phone. And you got to put the phone down, and then you call them back and say, the reason I hung up the phone is because I asked you not to do this anymore. And then they'll say, yeah, but you did it because you're under the influence of that neighbor that you have. Boom, and you hang up the phone again. Now,
yeah,
this doesn't mean you have
to
be...
Heart.
What?
To be
of course it's hard.
It's good to be young at heart.
It's good to be young at heart. But the thing that eventually you will do after you train your parents not to be overly protective is you'll find yourself grow up and
well,
be your own woman.
They were not overly protective.
Uh-huh.
They were not supportive.
They were not supportive.
No.
That's different than being protective, you know. Sometimes possessive people...
Uh-huh.
They protect, but they don't support. So thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. We'll take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Let's see. I'm definitely a fear-based person, anxiety, fear of abandonment, et cetera. Where it gets in the way, I mean, I understand a lot of my childhood, it came from the average... I guess I'm told it wasn't average, abusive alcoholic family. And we moved a lot, and I lost a lot of my, when I was a little girl, my dolls got lost, everything got lost. And so I know I have a lot of fears, but what I'd like to do is get over them. And I've gone to different 12-step programs, and they say fear means false evidence appearing real. My parents are both deceased. My father died when I was in my early teens, and I still carry them with me in my head. And one of the reasons, and it may sound silly, that I want to let go of all this fear-based behavior is that a couple of times when I was really little and then as a teenager, I had a problem trying to swim and I in the water and I almost drowned. And so I've always been afraid of water, but for some reason I've always been determined to learn how to swim because I think I love to watch swimmers and it's just so beautiful. So I thought I would like to do that. So I've persisted. So recently I was taking lessons again and the instructor, at least I've gotten to the point where I can float and I can move my arms and, you know, somewhat swim. But I don't seem to be able to go beyond that. And the instructor kind of yelled at me recently, and she said, Alice, I was in the water. She was testing each one of us. She said, Alice, where do you go? And I wasn't sure what she meant. And then she explained it, and she said, you get in the water, and you completely don't know where you are, and you just go numb. And so I told her later, I said, you know, it's interesting that you recognized that so quickly, and yet I've been to therapists where they don't get it. They aren't able to deal with me or deal with that. I would really like to get over that fear and all my fears. I mean, the fears that are holding me back what would I say, making life difficult.
When your father was a drinker?
Right.
When he would be screaming, yelling, did he hit your mother?
He didn't really hit her. He was very verbally abusive, though.
Very abusive. And when he would be abusive, would you tune out?
Oh, definitely. And
did
and
you
I
find
would
a way of...
He would beat me.
What?
He would beat me.
Also. Okay, and when he was beating you, and I'm sorry to
right.
hear that, where did you go with your mind?
I don't remember for sure, but I know I would go someplace.
You would leave, of course.
Yeah,
it's called dissociation. It is the most... It's a smart move. You know, if your body is being beaten, the best thing to do is to leave your body, because you know if you make too much sound, he's going to hit you even harder. You know if you object, it's going to get even worse. So you do what everybody does. You close in and you leave town with your mind.
Right.
Somehow... water and drowning is associated in your mind with being beaten as a child. There is a connection between those two. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a direct way to find out, which could be through some regressive hypnosis. That's one way, possibility to find a link. But I have another solution. And this solution is, you're going to find very unusual. Which is, I want you to go to a store and buy yourself a doll. I want you to get yourself one of those dolls that you lost that meant so much to you. And I want you to find it. You might go to a store like the Enchanted Forest up on Lexington Avenue or one of the other places that have these dolls. The dolls can come as close to you as possible. What do you think? What do you feel when I say these words to you?
I'm trying very hard not to cry, but I'm just crying. I don't know why. I just feel, I don't know, like sad. And yet I think I would really like to do that. But as soon as you said that, I started crying.
Yes, finding your doll. Find that. Bring it back to yourself. In fact, I'd really appreciate it if one day when you find your doll, and you're going to see her, you'll see her when you go into the store, you'll see her. When you find your doll, have both of you give us a call back here, would you? It's going to change your life.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Let's see, where do I want to start? Anxiety despite reckless behavior. There's been a relative way I've lived since a teenager. Now, I don't know if the use of stimulants, including methadone and cocaine, could be the cause of the anxiety, but the reckless behavior was prior to the use of such. At my age, 33, I think I've changed that type of behavior considerably, but there's still the fear of making long-term friendships.
Sure. Let me ask you something.
Sure.
How long have you wanted to die?
Never.
Did you ever think to yourself, wouldn't it be wonderful if it would just be over?
Not really.
So no. You have never confronted death itself?
Well, not on a suicidal level.
Not on a suicidal note, but as a, you know, because, you know, when you think about somebody like you and you think about the risks you've taken, including the drugs and the alcohol and all the other stuff that you did, it was like a surefire path to death's door.
Well, in fact, it was. It was a path of self-destruction because this was a period of time when I was trying to deal with the rejection.
Sure.
The total rejection of myself from my family, my mother and father. And during they were, him in particular, was trying to get, I believe my brothers and sisters also reject me.
Sure.
So I felt, apparently I felt really bad about myself and subconsciously was trying, I guess, to, you know, find a...
To do yourself in.
Yeah.
Just to end your time here on the planet.
Yeah. And
something came up.
I was wild and reckless for years with no goals and aims. For years.
I understand, but you seem to have turned it around quite a bit.
Said it again?
You seem to have turned it around quite a bit.
Considerably.
How'd you do it?
Well, I guess... And on one level, I just wanted to grow up and take care of my children, my family, the ones I care about, my wife. Living through her own issues, her own problems.
It's great when somebody can care as much about his family as you do, and that does turn you around. It does make a difference. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for taking it.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to have to be going. Two things I want to announce. We know of someone who is forming a new women's group for mothers. the daytime group for mothers. I could get you that information if you contact me, armand@brainlink.com on the internet. Mothers, because what he's saying makes all the difference in the world. If you care enough about a child to have questions and be able to gather with a group of mothers where you can kind of share information and look at, you know, what's going on inside you, the loneliness, the sadness. Feel free to send me a note. I'll get you the information on that. Number one and number two, we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. And once again, if you know of somebody who wants to work in a clinical office like ours, be sure to give us a call. We'll see what we can find for them. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. This is Armand DeMille.